Before we get to the show, we're a few weeks into the Newsmatch campaign, and we need your help. As a listener of the world, you know the value of our journalism. Now is the time to step up and support it. Make a donation today at theworld.org/match to double your impact. That's theworld.org/match. Thank you.
The day after impeachment, who says Washington can't cooperate? Politicians from both sides agree the USMCA trade agreement, an updated NAFTA, is a winner.
The USMCA will be the most modern, cutting-edge trade agreement in history.
Trade agreement is much better than NAFTA.
And the economic situation in Sudan was dire.
We were standing in line for like 4 hours, 5 hours to get bread. Stand for like 12 hours in line to get a gallon of gas.
So the Sudanese overthrew their government. Now they want relief from U.S. sanctions. And a message from the Queen.
My government's priority is to deliver the United Kingdom's departure from the European Union on the 31st of January.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Three speeches, three leaders, three countries. A president, a dictator, and a queen. All dealing with critical issues. Nationalism is on the rise, and leaders in the U.S., Russia, and the U.K. are turning away from the international community. In the United States, President Trump became the third president impeached in U.S. history. After the vote, he was defiant.
The do-nothing Democrats are declaring their deep hatred and disdain for the American voter. This lawless partisan impeachment is a political suicide march for the Democrat Party. Have you seen my polls in the last 4 weeks? It's crazy. You know why? They've been trying to impeach me from before I ran.
Across the pond in Great Britain, Boris Johnson's new tenure as prime minister begins with the opening of Parliament and announcing his agenda for the government. No surprise, the top item on his agenda, Brexit.
This Queen's speech of this people's government sets in motion a vast interlocking program to unite and level up across the whole United Kingdom and unleash the potential of all our people.
The Queen actually read Johnson's words. More on that in a bit. And over in Russia, President Vladimir Putin is holding his annual press conference, facing hours of questions from reporters. He took questions about Russia's doping scandal, nuclear weapons, and whether to remove Vladimir Lenin's body from Red Square, and his thoughts on the U.S. impeachment. More details from Russia also in just a few moments. Now back to the U.S., where members of Congress woke up to a new reality. This morning, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi was resolute. Impeaching the president was necessary.
No one is above the law, and the president has been held accountable. It really is interesting to see the response that we are getting bipartisan across party lines. I myself want to say I have a spring in my step because of the moral courage of our caucus.
The vote in the House passed almost completely along party lines. And now there's questions swirling about how an anticipated Senate trial regarding President Trump's conduct toward Ukraine could go. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell signaled today that Republicans in the Senate were ready for a fight.
This is by far the thinnest basis for any House-passed presidential impeachment in American history. The thinnest. And the weakest, and nothing else even comes close.
Now back to Russia. Every year, Russian President Vladimir Putin holds an end-of-the-year marathon press conference. Putin talked about the U.S. impeachment trial. He said President Trump was targeted for made-up reasons. Reporter Charles Maines has been following the press conference in Moscow.
Russia has this point of view that seems to often be in line with Fox News, with the Trump White House. And once again, we heard Putin say that he thinks this is basically an invented scenario by the Democrats to take Trump out. He was actually asked by a Russia pundit who's an American citizen, Dmitry Symes, about, you know, how he saw U.S.-Russian relations in the post-Trump era. And he said, look, I'm not so sure that Trump's presidency is coming to an end. He noted that the impeachment bill still needs to go through the Senate, where, of course, Donald Trump has much more support from Republicans. But he went on to say he thinks that these are completely fabricated charges against Trump.
Charles, what is the premise of this annual event anyway?
Well, it happens every December. It's kind of a year closer to assess what success the Russian government's had, what failures as they were. It's also an event where Putin is essentially cast as the father of the nation. I mean, he has, I think it was over 1,800 journalists this time in the room, quarreling essentially to get questions put to him. Of course, not everyone could, but the session did go over 4 hours. So it's been kind of a test also of, I suppose, Putin's endurance. And it's everything from small regional issues, events of national concern, as well as geopolitics.
Charles, are the questions that Putin gets, are they vetted, or are there any surprises or critical questions that slip through?
You know, it's funny you ask. I think the sense is that it is pretty free format on this occasion. There may be a few planted questions, but of course, there are too many moments where Western journalists, for example, get to ask a question. There was a tough one, for example, from the BBC asking about Putin's daughters, which has been a taboo subject, and Putin kind of didn't quite answer. You don't really get a follow-up question. That's part of the issue. So he can control the format, but you had several questions that were tough regarding issues that have been, you know, sticking points between Russia and the West. Also, some questions from Russian journalists talking about tough issues involving healthcare, problems with things like that. But on the other hand, you also have a moment when a Bulgarian journalist suddenly reads an Orthodox prayer to Putin and everyone applauds. So somehow there's a lot of applause come from the journalists themselves in the hallway, which suggests that they're not exactly independent players.
I was surprised to hear that Putin raised global warming. In fact, he made really strong comments about how the Russian Arctic is being affected by climate change. What did he say?
Well, you know, again, he's given different signals on this. Today he was asked about climate change, and he said, well, look, you know, we have, he's somewhere between, I guess you would call like a Republican position in the U.S. and the Democrats. He says, look, you know, some of these patterns, we don't know why it's happening. So it sounds a little bit like a climate science denier. And then all of a sudden he said, but look, we also recognize that this affects the Arctic more than other areas. And which is true. And he noted the fact that Russia has more cities up in the Arctic than most countries in the world, in fact, has the most. So he pointed out the fact that you have cities built on permafrost here in Russia. And if the permafrost was to melt, a lot of the structures of these cities would be affected. He suggested that this is something that Russia was planning to tackle. He noted they were part of the Paris climate talks and had signed the Paris climate accords. But at the same time, he seems to kind of suggest that it may be other factors at play here, but that Russia will do its part.
Now, of course, another big issue is how long Putin will remain in power. He's been in power in Russia for 20 years as president or prime minister. His current and final term ends in 5 years, but there's so much speculation he'll find a way to actually remain in power. How did he deal with that topic today?
Well, it was interesting. It came up in a question that wasn't directly related to that. He was talking about constitutional reforms involving the lawmakers with the Duma, and then he just noted something that came up relative to the presidency as well. So that's Putin saying that, you know, one thing that could be changed about these presidential terms is removing the clause about successive terms. You know, in other words, that you could take away this successive two-term limit, which opens the way for Putin to stay in power. So, of course, that garnered a lot of headlines here.
I bet. Charles Maines in Moscow with the highlights of Russian President Vladimir Putin's hours-long question and answer session today. Thanks a lot, Charles.
Thank you.
After Putin's press conference, a lone gunman opened fire in downtown Moscow. The apparent target was the headquarters of Russia's FSB, the country's intelligence service. Video on social media showed automatic gunfire hitting the walls of the building. People screamed as they fled the area, which is also a popular shopping destination for tourists. One Russian security officer was killed before the assailant was neutralized, to use the language of the police press statement. At least 5 other people were wounded, some seriously. The gunman has not been identified, and no clues have been released as to a possible motive. Now back to that third event we were talking about, the Queen of England's speech.
My government's priority is to deliver the United Kingdom's departure from the European Union on the 31st of January. My ministers will bring forward legislation to ensure the United Kingdom's exit on that date, and to make the most of the opportunities that this brings for all the people of the United Kingdom.
The Queen was addressing Parliament at the opening of the new session a week after a general election, an election that gave Boris Johnson and his Conservative Party a thumping majority after they campaigned on taking Britain out of the European Union. Rob Watson is the BBC's political correspondent. So, Rob, first point for a U.S. audience, and maybe for me in particular, is that the Queen's speech is not actually the Queen's speech, is it?
Goodness, no, not in the sense that she sits there and writes it and agonizes. What on earth is she going to tell her government to do? Not at all. So it is written for her by the government. But don't forget, in the UK system, she is the head of state. So in the same way, she holds the same role as president, if you like.
Yes, but still, it's confounding to our morning editorial meeting that the Queen's speech, it's actually written by Boris Johnson, and then she utters it as if it's her saying it?
Exactly. So it's written, and I'm not sure whether Boris Johnson writes every single word, but traditionally it is written by the government for the Queen, for the monarch to read out. Yeah.
Okay, so what did the Queen, not Queen, say about in her speech, not her speech?
So I guess there were two big things. I mean, the first one, and you wouldn't be surprised to hear this, would you, that she said her government was determined to get Brexit done. That was, after all, Mr. Johnson's famous slogan throughout the recent election campaign. And really what's meant by that is that the UK will formally withdraw from the European Union at the end of January. I'm sure that that is going to happen. And then the UK and the EU will try to negotiate a new relationship before 2020. 20 is out. The other thing, of course, that Mr. Johnson is promising to these more, how should I describe them, working class voters that he managed to gain is that somehow public services would improve in this country. So that's things like education, health, transport, but also somehow without the government borrowing vast amounts of money or taxing people more.
Okay, I'm going to come back to my pet peeve, which is, what if the Queen doesn't like what's in the speech or doesn't believe it? Does she still have to say it?
That's an easy one. That's tough. I mean, that's just tough. She absolutely has to. I mean, there have been periods in history where we've sort of heard, we've never been quite sure that the monarch didn't like something. So I remember as a much, much younger reporter when Mrs. Thatcher was in power and was really dramatically changing the state, privatizing vast swathes of the UK economy, that apparently the Queen thought this was like selling off the family silver, the family jewels. But apart from that, whatever she thought, she just had to get on with it.
Did you see any sneers or growls? Hear any growls from her or anything?
No. I think, is that a reference to the fact that that David Cameron, a former prime minister, once said that he heard the Queen purring like a cat when Scotland voted to remain in the UK? Now you're starting to worry me, Carol, that I'm getting into sort of treasonous territory.
No, this is just something that we erupted this morning about this Queen's speech, which is not the Queen's speech. But anyway, okay, I want to go back to the other thing, which was a little different this year, is that normally the so-called Queen's speech is a very formal event with gilded carriages and fabulous robes. But there was none of that today. How come?
No, but I mean, look, nobody should be under any illusion. She didn't sort of get on a bike or anything or hail a taxi or do Uber or something and sort of trot along in her raincoat or actually walk. I mean, it would only take about 5 or 10 minutes to walk from Buckingham Palace to Parliament. I mean, by the standards of most, I was about to say, normal people, normal countries, it's still pretty grand. I mean, there are people with trumpets, right? I mean, this is stuff that goes back to the 17th, 16th century and all sorts of people in extraordinary uniforms and someone called Black Rod banging on a door. So don't worry, you know, there was plenty of the kind of the pageantry crazy stuff that we Brits are famous for. It's just that she didn't have a crown on. She didn't have what's known as a sort of formal attire. She just had a what is it called? A day suit. And I think it was a rather fetching green hat.
Now, with the landslide victory for Boris Johnson's Conservative Party, it seems like the UK has sort of turned a corner. I mean, a week later, what's the mood in the country?
That is a very good question. So I don't think there's any doubt, and you know, regular listeners will know I often describe Britain as being in its most profound political crisis since the Second World War as a result of the deadlock over Brexit. I think it's too soon to say that the UK is somehow out of the crisis, but I think we're in a new phase and it's certainly a new era. And it certainly feels like a lot of the tension has gone out of the air now, whether that is permanent, whether that'll start up again when Britain starts to renegotiate its new relationship with the European Union in the new year. I simply don't know, Carol, but I know that that is the key question in British politics. Does it all calm down or does it all blow up again?
The BBC's Rob Watson in London. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World.
As a listener of The World, you know that our journalists bring new perspectives and insights to issues like climate change. Just this year, reporter Carolyn Beeler spent 2 months on an expedition to Antarctica studying the effects of climate change and reporting for The World. Shirin Jafari took us inside Saudi Arabia to report on the changing role of women there and barriers to those changes. Producer Daniel Offman and I traveled to Russia to meet young people who love Vladimir Putin and others who organize in opposition to him. Not every newsroom would invest in this kind of reporting, but we do. If you value in-depth, on-the-ground journalism that brings you right into the story, then step up and support it today. A gift of any size makes a difference, but if you donate $60 today, that will be doubled to $120. Just visit theworld.org/match. Thanks very much.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. A year ago today, a student protest began in the small city of Atbara. They were frustrated that the price of bread had gone up. That frustration soon spread across Sudan. Calls grew for the country's president to step down. He did. Over the weekend, Omar al-Bashir was sentenced to 2 years in prison, something that would have been unimaginable a year ago. That protest movement transformed Sudan, but there's one issue that lingers. The World's Halima Gikandi has the story.
Ahmed Muzamil is a 28-year-old pharmacist. He spent his entire life in Sudan's capital city of Khartoum. But last year, he reached a breaking point.
The situation was completely unbearable. And this is not a personal experience. This is an experience that most of the youth will tell. They were thinking of traveling to Gulf State because they are near. They were immigrating to Canada and Europe.
And Muzamil started planning to leave himself. His work life had become difficult, medicines were hard to find, and his patients' lives were in danger. Even finding the most basic goods was a struggle.
We were standing in line for like 4 hours, 5 hours to get bread, stand for like 12 hours in the line to get a gallon of gas.
But in December 2018, something changed that made Muzamil decide to stay. Hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets across the country. In a few months, they brought down President Omar al-Bashir. The dictator has been replaced by a civilian-led transitional government. The goal is to hold democratic elections by 2022. But despite all this political change, Sudan's economy is stuck. And that's got many people in Sudan asking about U.S. sanctions.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to start with a statement concerning Sudan.
The sanctions on Sudan go back to 1993. That's when the Clinton administration put Sudan on the list of state sponsors of terrorism. The designation brought a whole host of financial and export sanctions on Sudan that remain in place today. Other U.S. sanctions have followed. The goal of these sanctions was to isolate Sudan from the community of civilized nations, and it did. Today, Sudan is virtually cut off from the international banking system. Its crushing national debt has reached $60 billion.
U.S. sanctions have choked off Sudan from private investment, except from the most risky investors.
Cameron Hudson is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He served as the director of African Affairs on the National Security Council under the Bush administration. Hudson says that the conversation about delisting Sudan has ebbed and flowed between administrations. In 2017, the U.S. removed some trade and economic sanctions in Sudan. By then, the country had actually become a partner in countering terrorism. But Ahmed Muzamil, the pharmacist, hasn't felt the difference.
Not at all. At all. After the removal of those sanctions, we felt that things maybe will change because the government all the time said those sanctions were the main responsible for economical prosperity. But after the removal of those sanctions, we understand that there is another factor.
Last week, a group called Friends of Sudan met in Khartoum to meet with Sudan's leaders. The group was formed after Bashir was ousted from power. It's made up of a coalition of countries and global institutions that have committed to supporting Sudan's new civilian-led government. Some countries have called on the U.S. to remove the terror designation and the sanctions in order to open up the country's economy to investment and debt relief. But the U.S. hasn't given a clear indication of if and when this could happen. According to Hudson, America's diplomatic, intelligence, and defense communities are deeply divided.
They're going to want a little more confidence that this government or any civilian government is going to be able to outlive the transitional period so that they don't have kind of regrets at the end of this if they take them off the list and then find out that military comes back in to rule the country.
Hudson also says that on the six occasions the U.S. has removed countries from the state sponsors of terrorism list, it hasn't always gone well. But he said that ultimately, the risks of keeping Sudan on the terrorism list outweigh the risks of taking it off.
We haven't seen the door of opportunity open this wide for 30 years. And so there's a sense of this is a unique moment in time. And if we don't do everything we can with this moment, then we will lose it.
But attorney William Wheeler views it differently. He represents more than 560 people who have sued the Sudanese government for the role it played in the 1998 terrorist attacks on U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. 200 people died in the attacks and several thousand people were injured.
Companies that violate the sanction regimes are paying, but the country of Sudan has not paid one penny yet. And to come off the terrorism list, they have to step up and, I think, negotiate directly with the people they injured, the people they killed and injured, the U.S. government employees and their family members.
But for the people of Sudan living under a crippled economy, there's no time to waste. Those are the crimes of the old regime. Ahmed Wazamil wishes that the U.S. and international community would have more faith in what the Sudanese people have accomplished.
We made now a revolution. We made a change in all that. We have a government that is leading the transition state toward a free and fair election. We are now prospering a massive freedoms. We are now moving towards peace. So things are getting better.
And lifting U.S. sanctions, Wazamil says, would only help Sudan continue to move forward. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi.
We're heading into deep December, and that means winter vacation for American school kids. Our next story takes us to a school in South Korea where the normal school calendar has been set aside because the school has no students, at least not kids. The world's Bianca Hillier explains.
That's right, zero students. Zero new students enrolled at a rural elementary school in South Korea last year. Chairs were left empty. Lee Ju-young is the school's principal.
Our school is deep in the countryside, so not only is the population low, but the birth rate also keeps dropping.
So the school came up with a plan. Fill the empty chairs with local elders who didn't know how to read or write. 75-year-old Hwang Bok Nim is one of the school's new students.
Now that I'm going to school, I'm learning new things. It's been really nice.
Principal Lee Ju-young said the elderly students are mostly women.
They've lived all their lives sacrificing for their families, usually male siblings. There was a culture of sending sons to school but not daughters. The root cause was poverty.
As a child, Bok Nim went to school for only one day. She had to work instead to make money for her family. Now, Bok Nim knows how to read and write, but the school has given her more than literacy.
I really like that I have a place to go at this age.
Another reminder that there's always time for lifelong learning. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Bianca files a daily story for The World's Smart Speaker Show. It's called The Number in the News. Add The Number in the News to your news queue on your Alexa or Google Home smart speaker. You're with The World. In Germany, right-wing extremism is on the rise.
Every day there are police reports about swastikas and Hitler salutes. But it even goes so far that it has become a part of everyday life.
In response, the city council in Dresden passed a motion saying it's facing a Nazi emergency. That story and more coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. Right-wing extremism is on the rise in Germany, with the growth of the far-right Alternative for Germany party. Support for the AfD has soared in cities like Dresden in eastern Germany. In response, the city council there has passed a motion saying Dresden is facing a Nazi emergency. Here's The World's Orla Berry.
As I arrive at Dresden's main train station, I'm faced with a group of white men, mainly middle-aged or older, singing what appears to be a traditional German ballad. Some are waving German flags. Others hold up placards bearing German Chancellor Angela Merkel's face. Underneath are the words traitor and war criminal. These are members of Pegida, an anti-Islam movement that began in Dresden 5 years ago. Many have called for these monthly marches to be banned, but not local councillor Wolf Hagenbraun. He's with the far-right AfD party.
Gott sei Dank auch in Deutschland die Demonstrationsfreiheit haben.
We have, you know, the freedom to assemble in Germany, the freedom to protest. That's very important, and that covers, obviously, the legitimacy of Pegida to go onto the street.
Many Pegida members are also supporters of the AfD. Councillor Brown sits on the city council, which passed a motion last month declaring a Nazi emergency in Dresden. He dismisses it.
Das Problem ist natürlich der Eindruck, den Dresden jetzt nach außen erweckt.
It's an image of Dresden where, you know, people imagine that the masses are running through the streets. But to be honest, it really isn't that way. There's been increasing polarization in the political atmosphere, and this has led our political opponents to use more radical measures to attack us.
One of those opponents is fellow city councillor Max Aschenbach of the left-leaning satirical party Die Partei. He proposed the emergency motion.
Because in Dresden, and not just in Dresden, we definitely have a big problem with right-wing and extreme right-wing people.
Aschenbach says his motion is not just about anti-Islam protesters gathering on the streets, but the rise of the far right in government.
Es gibt alltäglich Polizeimeldungen über Hakenkreuze und Hitlergrüße.
Every day there are police reports about swastikas and Hitler salutes, but it even goes so far that it has become a part of everyday life.
The far right party, the AfD, has been particularly successful in elections in Dresden this fall. Part of their support was driven by anti-immigrant sentiment. Many of their voters also say they feel abandoned by the traditional political parties, and the AfD is swooping in on those disaffected right-wing voters, some of whom have extremist views.
The AfD consists at least partly of Nazis.
This is Christoph Meiselbach, a political scientist at the Technical University in Dresden.
And I would say they are a problem that shouldn't be underestimated, because the more radical persons in the AfD seem to be dangerous people. And the suspicion is that the AfD doesn't get elected despite the fact that there are these radicals, but because there are these radicals.
Meiselbach tells me these are threatening times for non-Germans and Muslims in Dresden. So I go to see Umar Malik. He's a local imam born in Germany with family roots in Pakistan.
Yes, yes. There are people who are racist and they say it openly to migrants.
The imam is cautious, though, about being too critical of any group in Dresden.
There are also good people here who help and who are against this Nazism and this racism against foreigners.
Then I ask him if Muslims feel free to practice their religion in Dresden.
I think it's a problem. It's a challenge. For example, there is a Marwa el-Sherbini Centrum here in Dresden. A lot of Muslims go there for the Friday prayers. And there was a group of right-wing people. They demonstrated against the Muslims and
Imam Malik says the protests outside the Islamic Cultural Center continued every Friday for some time. Eventually, the authorities became involved and the protests stopped. What he doesn't mention is that the centre was named after an Egyptian woman, Marwa el-Sherbini, who was murdered in Dresden in 2009. The court concluded that her killer was partly motivated by a hatred of foreigners. Imam Malik tells me the rise of support for the far-right AfD party here doesn't threaten him.
I'm a German. They can't restrict me to live. This is a fundamental right.
So will this motion declaring a Nazi emergency in Dresden actually achieve anything? Political scientist Christoph Meiselbach is not convinced.
I think in what it really wants to achieve, namely fighting Nazis / fighting the AfD, I'm not sure whether it is very helpful with this, because the most complicated task that we have today is separate the real Nazis from those other people which for some reasons vote for the AfD. This is the central task.
This week, German authorities announced that one of their tasks would be to step up the fight against right-wing extremism. They're creating 600 new intelligence posts to target right-wing extremists and their networks. The AfD may find itself under greater scrutiny than ever before. But the next Pegida rally has already been planned for January in Dresden. For the World, I'm Orla Barry, Dresden.
Forget the impeachment, that's yesterday's news. Today, Washington is a place of harmony. The House of Representatives has found a place to agree. The new trade pact between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico is a winner. The new NAFTA is being called the USMCA here. That's short for the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement. President Trump loves it.
The USMCA will be the most modern, cutting-edge trade agreement in history.
Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi had some good things to say about it, too.
There is no question, of course, that this trade agreement is much better than NAFTA.
The new trade agreement isn't a radical overhaul, though. It's more a modernization of a 25-year-old trade agreement. But one big change is coming to the auto industry all across North America and how cars and trucks are built. Joining me now is Julie Freem, head of the Original Equipment Suppliers Association, a group that represents the auto supplies industry. Julie, what are the big changes in the new trade agreement when it comes to the auto industry?
Changes are coming in terms of how much labor and the amount of content that will need to be produced in the North American region.
What did it used to be and what is it now?
So regionally, we used to need 62.5% from one of the three countries, and now it's increasing to 75% for most parts.
And so does that include parts and labor or just parts?
Labor is going to be measured separately, and the labor value content will need to have, depending on the product, a certain percentage also.
So 75% of the parts in a particular vehicle are going to have to be made in North America?
Yes, depending on what the parts are, but yes.
And how do you see that impacting the industry and jobs?
First of all, it provides economic certainty and opportunity for automotive suppliers. It will enable manufacturing growth and jobs growth in the U.S., as well as throughout the entire region.
Now, moving on to labor conditions, what does this deal mean for auto workers across North America?
From a labor perspective, it's no significant change in terms of auto workers within the U.S. There will be opportunities for additional jobs, which is something that certainly labor looks forward to.
But I understand that there's a new requirement that 40 to 45% of a vehicle's contents will need to be made by workers earning at least $16 an hour. Isn't that a big deal?
Yes, that is a very big deal. And I think for the most part, we'll see the auto manufacturers be able to meet those requirements from their own facilities.
Isn't that a big increase in a place in Mexico where the prevailing wage at Mexican auto factories is much lower?
It certainly would be. The total wage in Mexico is generally lower than that. However, most of the manufacturers believe that they can meet that requirement in the U.S. with their existing facilities and sourcing.
In the United States, President Trump has argued that these rules under the new trade agreement would spur tens of thousands of jobs. But economists also worry that higher wages could lead to an unintended consequence, a threat to jobs, because higher costs mean more expensive cars, which could mean fewer sold.
Given now that we understand and will know once it passes and the detailed regulations are rolled out, given that we will understand that economic certainty then enables investments to occur throughout the region, given that certainty. That has been one of the most challenging issues we've faced, is we didn't know what was going to happen. And so we were, as an industry, it was difficult to make investments not knowing what the rules were going to be.
Julie Freem is president of the Original Equipment Suppliers Association, a group that represents the auto supplies industry. Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thank you.
There was another change to U.S. trade policy this week. A country was quietly removed from the list of free trading partners. That country was Wakanda.
Wakanda forever!
Yes, that Wakanda, the fictional country from the Marvel superhero movie Black Panther. Wakanda had been listed as a free trade agreement partner on the Department of Agriculture's website. According to the listing, you could get your water chestnuts and cows from Wakanda tariff-free. Good to know. The agency removed Wakanda yesterday, saying a web developer had used it to test a tool on the site, but then forgot to remove it. Looks like the U.S. will need to go elsewhere for cheap water chestnuts. In Beirut, protesters gathered late into the night. It was a show of force against the country's new prime minister, Hassan Diab. Earlier in the day, Lebanon's parliament appointed Diab. He's an academic supported by the Iranian-backed Hezbollah movement. Diab takes the helm in Lebanon after protesters forced the country's longtime leader, Saad Hariri, to quit. Carmen Geha is one of those protesters. She's unimpressed with Diab and the way he's come to power.
He's not, you know, taken 10 minutes to say what his vision is for Lebanon, what he thinks about the economic crisis, what kind of government he wants to bring. We've been asking for a competent technocrat government. It doesn't mean that we want people only with the right specialties and degrees, but people who have the right governance competencies in order to get us out of this crisis and to bring Lebanon forward to the 24th century.
So Hassan Diab, I think he is a technocrat by training. What sort of candidate would you prefer?
Already the way that Minister Diab has taken to the position of prime minister has been very, very divisive. He's been named by one sort of political alliance against another political alliance. So a technocrat is someone who's capable of talking to all sides. And I'm not saying it's impossible for him to do that. But a technocrat is not someone on paper who's a specialist. It is also someone who is able to govern, who is diplomatic, who is not going to be accountable to the party that brought him to power, but who is going to be accountable to the judiciary and accountable to the people. And that is certainly, there's not been any public deliberation around the kind of prime minister and the requirements that we want to see in that person.
Now, on Wednesday, just yesterday, you and the rest of Beirut woke up to find a large cement wall blocking roads. What's going on with that wall? What's its purpose?
Yeah, it's terrible. The purpose, as the Minister of Interior said on television last night, is basically to give riot police a break because they've been having a difficult time, keeping the protests safe. We've been attacked, particularly by Amal supporters and Hezbollah supporters. We know this because they carry the flags and they repeat those slogans. We know exactly where they come from, what they're doing. So she said that wall is being built to make it easier for riot police to keep us safe. But also it's very symbolic because they built it around the parliament. And so essentially what it means to me is this is a parliament that is locking itself up and locking people outside because it is a parliament that is not loved by Lebanese people. It is a parliament that hasn't been able to legislate a law for independent judiciary system to investigate not a single act of corruption. For me, the wall is they know that they're not loved, they know that they're not popular, and they want to lock themselves in this little square. So we've been building bridges and they've been locking down essentially empty buildings. I mean, the parliament has not met in months. There is no reason why they need to put cement walls to block an entrance to a parliament.
But what are you looking for? I mean, you say you want to change the system, and it seems like the system of sort of rotation of governments was created, as you say, after the Lebanese Civil War, which was a brutal civil war. Isn't that system of rotation one that keeps the country at peace?
What we have is not a system of rotation of power. We have a power-sharing system. And the idea was to bring warring factions back into the table, was that they would agree to share power. The idea of it is not malicious per se, but the practice of it ended up being very malicious. It's like they took the intent of the system, which was that different factions share power and eventually democratized the system. They took this intention and distorted it and turned it into a system where they divide, the spoils of the state. They divide the ministries among each other. And eventually, 30 years down the line, made it impossible to do any slight, small economic reform. You just have to look at the environmental crisis. They've been given the same company the last 30 years, the monopoly over garbage. We throw our garbage in the sea or we burn it. And people are dying because of garbage. They failed at every level. Now, what do we want out of these protests? Like I said, I'm not ignorant. I know that change needs time, but the demands have been overwhelmingly united in the sense that, we're in trouble. We don't know what kind of political system we want in 10 years. Yes, we're not in agreement about elections and women's representation, but we're in agreement about getting competent technocrats in the governance sense to get us out of this mess. And they're still playing with the pre-revolution tools. You know what I mean? Like the way they did the consultations, the way they did the nomination. Perhaps Minister Diab, Prime Minister Diab will be able to do well, but my fear is that, we get stuck between this moment of aspiration and they're just doing business as usual.
Carmen Geha is an activist and an assistant professor at the American University of Beirut in Lebanon. Thanks a lot, Carmen.
Thanks, Carol.
The bathroom door doesn't close, the shower gel dispenser is upside down, and there's a 3-foot-tall padded edge all the way around the mattress. To get into the bed, you have to do some climbing. You'll find this if you go to the Art B&B in Blackpool, England. And if that sounds like the worst hotel room ever, that's the point. It's the brainchild of artist Christopher Samuel. His goal is to give visitors a taste of the access problems faced by many disabled people.
It looks quite normal until you look a bit closer. So, for instance, the toilet door is trapped behind the toilet, so you can't shut it. Light switches are in a difficult position, so it's not so accessible. You can't sit underneath the table because I've designed it so the chair is flush with the top of the table. And I raised the bed slightly. You can get into it, but it's difficult. So you're, over time, you'll find that it wasn't designed for you.
So you're making a point with the design of this room, and that's to give people a sense of what it's like to navigate hotel rooms and all sorts of spaces in a wheelchair.
Yes, I think it's not just about me being in a wheelchair. It's about access, accessibility for people with different impairments. But more to the point, those who are able-bodied, to get them to think about accessibility and what that means to them. Maybe relatives, friends, family, or people they don't even know, you know, and service industry who design these spaces are clearly not designing the spaces with disabled people in mind. I think it's this one-size-fits-all kind of culture, which is not acceptable in this day and age.
This was inspired by a period in your own life when you were living in a hotel room, right?
Yes. So I was forced to take emergency accommodation in a hotel room while two local authorities were fighting over whose responsibility it was to rehouse me and whose responsibility it was to pay for my care. In that process, I took up emergency accommodation in a hotel, which was labeled a disabled room, which clearly wasn't. I couldn't use the table. I couldn't sleep in the bed. I could get into the bathroom, but the bathroom door couldn't shut. I couldn't actually use the toilet to use a bucket. I couldn't use the shower because the shower was inside a bath, which I couldn't get to. So there was just various things which was poorly designed.
You said you couldn't sleep in the bed. Where did you sleep?
In my wheelchair. Slept in my wheelchair for a few weeks.
The room you designed, it's in a B&B in Blackpool, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, so it's an art B&B. So they have 19 rooms, and each artist submitted a proposal to design a room. And my theme was, obviously, a room that wasn't accessible.
Are people actually able to stay in the room you designed?
Yes, that's the brilliant thing about it. You can book a night or a few nights if you like.
Has anyone stayed in your room yet?
Yes, someone stayed and they said it was brilliant. The first night was fantastic. The second night was not so funny. And the third night they were cursing me. So it worked.
Christopher Samuel is an artist in England who designed a hotel room based on the idea of accessibility. It's in a B&B called Art B&B in Blackpool, England. Thank you so much, Christopher.
Thank you.
Orca whales are some of the smartest animals on the planet. They're social, they hunt intelligently, and they're vocal. Surprisingly human. And just like humans, grandmothers can play an important part in raising young orcas. New research shows just how big of an impact those grandmas have on calves. Joining me now from Vancouver, Canada, is Lance Barrett-Leonard. He's an orca researcher at Oceanwise Conservation. Lance, how do older female orcas help raise young ones? What do they actually do?
Well, I think the first thing to understand is that older female killer whales, by the time their grandmothers, go through menopause. That's quite rare in the animal kingdom. But they can live for, you know, for a couple of decades easily, sometimes 3 or 4 decades after that. And she's definitely helping them find food sources. These older females are the repositories of information about what's worked for them in the past. So, you know, if a female decides we're going to swim 100 miles north of here, because in past years that's been a pretty good place, that's one of their utilities, if you like, or the functions that they serve in the group.
Do the grandma orcas also do just traditional babysitting like a lot of human grandmothers do?
Yeah, they do. We see them sometimes with their young grandkids near them, and the females are off a bit further away foraging. So they do serve that role to some extent. Interestingly, the males serve that role too. We actually see adult males babysitting their sisters' offspring, so their nieces and nephews. So the fathers of calves are actually not in the social group. They're usually, almost always, off in a different social group.
Doing what? What are dad orcas doing?
Well, they're babysitting their nieces and nephews.
But not their own baby orcas.
No. Presumably they don't really know who they are.
This is pathetic.
Well, I think it's kind of a good system. And, you know, some indigenous societies are a bit like that, where uncles and aunts play a really important role in the rearing of children.
What about Grandpa Orca? What's he doing?
So we don't know how many male orcas actually get to be grandpas while they're alive. They're quite a bit shorter lived than females. So by the time they have grand offspring, there's a good chance they've died. I've actually never had anybody ask me much about grandpas, but good for you. Interesting.
Now, my last question is a curiosity question I have about orcas. Are they really killer whales?
Yes, and I tend to slip in and out. I'm bilingual. I sometimes use killer whale, and most of my colleagues, when we're, you know, in scientific meetings and stuff, we call them killer whales. Many people feel it's not an appropriate word because they're highly intelligent, they're sensitive, and they're gentle, but they do kill other whales.
Do they kill humans? If I went out and tried to pet an orca whale, am I going to be done for?
Nope, you're safe, because they've got a very, very clear idea of what food is. They don't experiment much with that. And as far as humans are concerned, when humans, many occasions now of humans being in the water with orcas, and sometimes they may come and take a quick look, and they may be curious for a few minutes, but often they're not even particularly curious, and they just pass on by. We don't look like food to them, thank goodness.
Lance Barrett Leonard is the Director of Marine Mammal Research at OceanWise Conservation. Thanks a lot.
You bet. Thanks, Carol. Bye-bye.
And that's where we wrap things up today. From the warm and dry Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills, back with you tomorrow for another Spin of the World.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.